Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to the Islamic History Podcast. Today we are continuing our series called The Special Relationship, which discusses the relationship between the United States and Israel. In this episode, we will discuss some of the moral reasons that are often given for the U.S.'s continued support of Israel. In particular, we're going to talk about the 1947 UN Partition Plan, the 1948 Arab-Israeli War, and the 2000 Camp David Summit. Before we get started, I want to once again remind you to join the Islamic History Podcast group on Telegram. So if you are on Telegram, if you have an account on Telegram, go ahead and join the group if you can. It is currently an open group, so no invitation is required, though eventually, once the group gets large enough, probably around 50, 70 or so, we will restrict entrance and make it an invite-only group. But for right now, because I'm trying to build up the group, it is open for anyone to join if you'd like to. Within the group, I generally share transcripts of episodes I'm doing, my research notes for these episodes, old video clips, and lots of random things related to Islam and Islamic history. So give it a shot if you'd like to join. There's no cost, obviously. And let me know what you think about it. So let's get into our current episode about the special relationship. This is part three of what will likely be a four-part series. Now, the question, of course, comes up, why does the United States support Israel? This is the question that we've discussed in the previous episode. In the previous episode, we mentioned and debunked various strategic and supposedly rational reasons for the United States' support of Israel. We mentioned how the Cold War was given as an excuse or a reason. We debunked that. We discussed terrorism, and we also discussed the United States' desire to protect its oil interests in the region, in the Middle East. However, one of the most common reasons given for America's support of Israel is the moral reason. Like, the United States has a moral imperative, a moral obligation to support and protect the state of Israel. Some of the reasons are that Israel is a small country that is surrounded by enemies. Another reason that's often given is that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. I mean, how many times have we heard that one? Also, supporters of Israel try to portray Israel as this benevolent nation surrounded by a bunch of evil Arab states. So they often say how Israel uses great restraint when it is forced to carry out military operations, when it's forced to reluctantly carry out military operations. Israel uses great restraint to avoid harming civilians, while its opponents do not care and deliberately target civilians when it wants to attack Israel, when they want to attack Israel. Now, this next reason is more or less limited to the United States, though not exclusively so. That is Christian evangelicals. Lots of evangelical Christians believe that the Bible orders them to protect Israel, that they have a religious obligation to protect Israel. Some of these evangelicals believe that establishing a temple in what is now Al-Aqsa Masjid, will fast-track the rapture, that is, will fast-track the return of Isa alayhi salam, or Jesus Christ, as he's known in English, will fast-track his return and bring the righteous Christians up to heaven with Jesus and leave all the evil, non-believing heathens, which includes, by the way, Jews and Muslims, leave us here on earth to duke it out. So a lot of evangelicals want to fast-track this end-of-world ideology. Another moral reason given for supporting Israel is that the Jewish people have suffered a lot in the past, and therefore the United States must protect the Jewish state of Israel. And the final reason, the one that we're going to really talk about today, is that the Palestinians do not really want peace. The Palestinians want warfare. They want violence. They want to destroy Israel. Therefore, it is the righteous and moral thing, according to those who support Israel, to support Israel. And these supporters of Israel give several examples displaying or showcasing how the Palestinians do not really want peace. They talk about how the Palestinians, way back in 1947, rejected the United Nations two-state proposal, or the United Nations Partition Plan. They also mentioned how the Palestinians joined in the 1948 war to destroy Israel, and therefore the Palestinians are only suffering the consequences of their defeat in that war. Another very frequently given example of Palestinians not really wanting peace is that the Palestinians rejected Israel's peace offer during the 2000 Camp David summit. And more recently, especially after October 7th, 2023, the Palestinians are blamed for voting for Hamas in Gaza. Now, before we get to the main topic, that is particularly debunking three of these claims of the Palestinians not wanting peace, let's quickly debunk the other claims, some of which we debunked in the previous episode, but I'm just going to go through them again real quickly. Now, the first idea that Israel is surrounded by a bunch of enemies and hostile states that want to destroy it. This is not necessarily true. Many of the nations that surround Israel have peace treaties with Israel. For instance, Jordan, Egypt, the UAE, though it's not really surrounding Israel, but it is in that region, the UAE, Bahrain, and Turkey, or Turkey as it's known now, all of those nations are either allies or have written peace treaties with Israel and have open diplomatic relationships, all five of those nations. Now, there are other nations in the Middle East or in the region that do not have formal ties with Israel. For instance, Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is a big player in the region, obviously, and it does not have formal diplomatic ties with Israel, but up until October 7th, Saudi Arabia was well on its way to normalizing diplomatic relations with Israel. And there's lots of rumors that Saudi Arabia has back-channel ties with Israel, and it does still work with Israel, but it does so in a shadow manner, a way that is not explicit and open. Now, other nations that do not have formal ties, Iraq does not have formal ties with Israel. There doesn't appear to be any roadmap in place for that to happen. Iran obviously does not have any diplomatic relationships with Israel. Neither does Yemen. Neither does Kuwait, Qatar, Lebanon, nor Syria. Lebanon is a little more complicated. I'll get into that in a moment. Oman doesn't have official ties with Israel, but up until October 7th, Oman was moving towards recognizing Israel. Now, of these nations, only Syria, Iran, Lebanon, and Yemen are openly hostile to Israel. Syria, let's talk about that one first. Syria was not a military match for Israel even before its civil war, the Syrian civil war that began in 2011 with the Arab Spring. But after that devastating war that lasted nearly a decade, it is definitely too weak to really pose a serious threat to Israel. As for Lebanon, that's a little more complicated. With Lebanon, it's really Hezbollah that has its base and its headquarters within Lebanon that is hostile to Israel. The Lebanese government has a very complicated but overall negative relationship with Israel because Israel has invaded and bombarded Lebanon so many times. Lebanon did take part in the 1948 war. We'll talk about that soon. But Lebanon right now, however, doesn't have the military strength to be a true adversary, a true enemy to Israel. It can't really pose any true threat to Israel. And as for Iran, Iran is just too far away. Yes, Iran has lots of bluster, but Iran is too far away and also doesn't pose a serious military threat. And yes, the argument can be made that Iran could work through its proxies, either Hezbollah or the Houthis in Yemen or things like that. So that's possible, but it's not an existential threat to Israel. So that's the first idea bunk, that Israel is surrounded by a bunch of enemy nations. Not necessarily true. Next, we have the idea that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. Now, whether Israel is a true democracy, that is very much up for debate. I'm not sure how you can oppress the civil and political rights of 5 million people living within your borders and still call yourself a democracy. But hey, South Africa did the same thing, and it was considered a democracy. The United States did the same thing, and it was considered a democracy. So, whatever. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. The point of the matter is, we all know the United States doesn't really care about democracy. The United States has toppled legitimate democracies in the past. It has propped up dictators when it suited its interests. It has supported and allied with autocrats and dictators when needed. The idea of democracy being a reason to support a nation is foolishness. It is not relevant. The United States does what it has to do for its own interests, except in the case of Israel, because in this case it seems to operate against its interests, but that's neither here nor there. Actually, it is here nor there. That's exactly what we're talking about. But that's not the point I want to talk about right now. The point of the matter is that whether you want to consider Israel a true democracy or not, and as mentioned, that is very much up in the air right now, that is not a historical reason for directing United States international relations. Now, we're not going to really discuss the other reason as far as the evangelical Christian apocalyptic theology or ideology. We're not going to talk about that, but so much, mostly because the United States is a secular nation. It is not governed by religious laws. Yes, the majority of the population here do follow the Christian faith, some form of the Christian faith, but the United States is not a Christian nation. No matter how much people want to say it, this is a secular nation. The ideology of the nation, the constitutional framework of the nation was built upon the idea that religion does not play a role in its government. There's a clear separation in the United States between church and state. So the United States should not be making international diplomatic decisions based upon religion. Another thing is that Israel is a Jewish state. It is considered the Jewish homeland or the Jewish national state, however you want to call it. And Israel does not believe in Christian eschatology anyway. As a Jewish state, Christian eschatology has no bearing in its decisions. Now, I can understand from a strategic point of view why Israel may let these ideas carry on, but that is not a sound reason to base U.S. international diplomacy. Another moral reason for supporting Israel is the fact that Jews have suffered a lot in the past, and this is true. The Jewish people have suffered a tremendous amount in the past, but their suffering was not caused by Muslims, nor Arabs, nor Palestinians. They had nothing to do with the suffering that Jews have gone through over the centuries. Most Jewish suffering in the past occurred in European Christian nations. So it seems very odd that Muslims and Arabs have to pay for the crimes of European Christians. Logic would dictate that the European Christians would give up their land, some of their land, to make up for their ancestors' crimes. That's what logic would dictate. That's like the United States wanting to make amends for its crime against its black inhabitants, its black citizens, and saying that, you know, black people, the United States has done a lot of wrong to you. So here's Hong Kong. Go to Hong Kong. We're going to give you Hong Kong as your nation, as your state. We're going to support you in taking Hong Kong and building up a black nationalist nation there. See how crazy that sounds? Exactly. Furthermore, there are many other groups that have suffered just as much, if not more, than the Jewish people. As I just mentioned, people of African descent, particularly black people from sub-Saharan Africa or whose ancestry goes back to sub-Saharan Africa, they have suffered a whole lot. Black people have been enslaved. Africa has been colonized. Black people have been discriminated against all over the world, not just in Africa. We can talk about South Africa, the brutality against Africans there by the apartheid government of South Africa before 1993. Even now, almost 30 years since the end of apartheid, official end of apartheid in South Africa, most of the wealth in that nation is still controlled by the white minority in that nation. Here in the United States, black people have been were enslaved for 400 years, and they also, of course, had 100 years of our own version of apartheid, which we know as Jim Crow. And even today, black people still generally control a much, much smaller portion of wealth in the United States that is not in proportion to our numbers. And of course, we are often discriminated against in housing, employment, and the justice system, so forth and so on. I can talk in depth about that because, you know, I happen to be a Black American and I can relate to all of that. Another group of people that is often not talked about who have been persecuted and oppressed for centuries are the Roma. The Roma have been enslaved, they've been exiled from various lands, and they've been persecuted throughout Europe. Now, the word gypsy is considered a derogatory term, but still, the fact remains that the Roma have also been oppressed for many, many years, many centuries. And finally, this is just one more example, there are others, but finally, we have the Native Americans. The original people of this land, North and South America, have been nearly wiped off the face of the planet. There are only a few of them left. They're more predominant in South America and a little bit more in Central America, but in the Caribbean, in North America, almost completely gone. So, yes, Jewish people have suffered a lot, but so have many others, many of whom live right here within the borders of the United States. Okay, so now let's get into the real center point of this episode. The idea that the Palestinians have squandered away many previous chances for peace. Therefore, the conclusion is that they don't really want peace. They want violence, and therefore they deserve the oppression and persecution that they are experiencing. That's the next idea. Now, we mentioned these instances, these claims, these claimed instances where the Palestinians have supposedly rejected opportunities for peace. First, the Palestinians and the Arabs, they rejected the UN partition plan of 1947. Secondly, the Palestinians were on the losing side of the war in 1948, and their intention was to destroy and wipe out the Jews of Israel. Therefore, they deserve to be oppressed and suppressed. And even after that, according to those who support this idea that the Palestinians have squandered away chances for peace, they rejected Israel's peace offer in 2000. The 2000 Camp David Accords, Yasser Arafat, representing the Palestinian cause, rejected Ehud Barak's peace offer in 2000. There's another reason given, which is that, especially more recently after October 7th, that the Palestinians voted for Hamas in 2006. Now, I'm not going to go into too much depth into this ideology, the voting for Hamas in 2006, because first of all, we discussed this back in season 6 of the Islamic History podcast, but also I don't consider this as valid evidence. First of all, the United States and the European Union and the United Nations pushed for democratic elections in Palestine, and this is what they got. You want a democracy, and this is what you got. Secondly, there have not been any elections in Gaza since then. There have not been any elections in Gaza since 2006. Furthermore, Hamas only became the de facto government in Gaza when Israel sealed up Gaza and turned it into a concentration camp. Once Israel turned Gaza into a concentration camp, it sealed it off from the rest of the world and Hamas became entrenched. Another reason, Hamas has absolutely no authority in the West Bank, and the Palestinians there are still very much oppressed by Israel. So to say that had the Palestinians not voted for Hamas, well, yes, things would have been better than being genocided by the Israeli army and the Israeli Air Force and Navy. Yes, they may have been better off than that, but they would have still been an oppressed minority. And finally, the final reason is that the Israeli government has collaborated with Hamas. How are you going to blame them the Palestinians for voting for Hamas when the Israeli government works with Hamas and has collaborated and sent them suitcases full of money? Different story, but you know what I'm talking about. So I'm not going to really go into the whole Hamas in 2006. I'm not going to go into that. All right, so carrying on now. Let's get into these other three reasons, starting off with the United Nations Resolution 181. This is the 1947 United Nations Partition Plan. Before we get into that actual resolution from the United Nations, we got to go back to the history a little bit. Everything really begins with a Balfour Declaration. Again, season 5 and season 6 of the Islamic History Podcast to understand what that's all about. But the Balfour Declaration calls for, and I quote, "the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people," unquote. Not only does the Balfour Declaration call for a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine, it also strives to protect the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. And that's a quote there. So the Balfour Declaration was protecting Jewish people in Palestine as well as those who were not in Palestine. Now, to be fair, the Balfour Declaration did call for the protection of, and I quote again, civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, unquote. But only calls for the protection of those non-Jewish people for their civil and religious rights. Doesn't say anything about their national or political rights. Only saying that, yes, you can live in this in Palestine and you can practice your religion freely in Palestine, but doesn't give them any sort of political rights in Palestine. But of course, here's the problem. The Balfour Declaration was always impossible to implement. Even at that time, especially at that time, the Arabs were the majority in Palestine. There was no peaceful way to create a Jewish state and have representative government. Yes, you can use violence to create a Jewish state, which is what happened. Yes, you can strip away the civil and human rights of the people who are already there. You can kill a bunch of them off. You can exile them. You can kick them out of the nation. But there's no way you can humanely create a Jewish state in Palestine when there is already a huge Arab majority there. If there was going to be a truly democratic nation in Palestine with representative government, just like in South Africa before 1993, the majority population would have eventually controlled the nation. They would have to be, in order to maintain the power of the minority population, you would have to strip away the rights of the majority population. So there is no way to implement the Balfour Declaration without violence, persecution, and oppression. It was impossible. This leads us to the Peel Commission of 1937. We discussed this also in Season 6 of the Islamic History Podcast. The Peel Commission was established after several violent clashes between the Arabs and Jews living in Palestine. The Peel Commission published a report stating that the Balfour Declaration could never be properly imposed. It could never be properly implemented. And it mentioned the same conflicts that I mentioned earlier. Zionism was incompatible with Palestinian civil and political rights. There's no way the two can mesh. This same report then suggested partitioning Palestine into a Jewish state and an Arab state, with a third neutral state being governed by an international community, whatever that's supposed to mean, for the holy sites within Palestine. And this report acknowledged that there would have to be some sort of population transfer, meaning that Jews living in the Arab state in the proposed Arab state would have to move over to the proposed Jewish state, and vice versa. Arabs living in the proposed Jewish state would have to move to the proposed Arab state. But the British government ultimately rejected the Peel Commission's recommendation, feeling that it was impossible to implement. And maybe it was. But also, World War II was starting to get underway, and I think they got distracted and didn't really care after that. But the point of me mentioning the Peel Commission is that the Peel Commission report was the ancestor of the 1947 UN Partition Plan, which itself is the ancestor to the current proposed two-state solution. And so we have the UN Resolution 181, which proposed the partitioning of Palestine into a Jewish state and an Arab state. And as we know, the Arabs rejected this plan. Now, why did the Arabs reject it? They didn't reject it because they just didn't want peace. That's not why they rejected the plan. First of all, you have to understand that the various Zionist organizations, some military, some political, many of which we discussed in Season 6, they were working hand in hand with the United Nations to formulate this plan. So, of course, the end product was going to be biased in their favor. Furthermore, the first prime minister of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, and other Zionists, they acknowledged that they were only using the partition plan as a stepping stone to conquer all of Palestine. They were going to accept it on paper, but would eventually find a reason to conquer it all. While these negotiations were going on between the Zionist organizations and the United Nations, the Arab groups refused to participate. So we only had one side working with the United Nations to create this plan, and the result was horrible. Also, the supposed partitioning of Palestine was unfair to the Palestinians. I've uploaded a map to the Telegram group, to the Islamic History Podcast Telegram group, that shows how Palestine was going to look if it had followed the UN partition plan. The map that was decided upon by the United Nations and the Zionist organization that was working with, it created one continuous area for the Jewish-controlled lands, but three separate lands for the Arabs. That means there was no way to travel from one Arab territory within Palestine to another without crossing over Jewish lands. This would have made it very easy to cut off and weaken these different Arab lands within Palestine. Meanwhile, the Jewish territory was all one contiguous land. Go to the Islamic History Podcast Telegram group and join, and you'll see a picture of this map. This situation was very similar to the partitioning of India in 1948, where East and West Pakistan were separated by India. Now, of course, the land was much larger in the Indian partitioning, but the concept was still the same. The Muslim nation was severely weakened by being divided into a bunch of smaller territories. Furthermore, the plan gave 56% of the land to the Jews, while the Arabs only got 42%. At this time, Arabs outnumbered Jews in Palestine 3-1. So how do you give the larger population the smaller territory? So, of course, it comes as no surprise that the Zionists and the representatives for Israel accepted this partitioning plan, and the Arabs rejected it, which ultimately led to the 1948 war. So, yes, while we can see that the Arabs and the Palestinians rejected the UN partitioning plan, the plan wasn't fair to begin with. Finally, there is the idea that since the Palestinians lost the war in 1948, the Israelis have the right to do whatever they want. Now, I'm not going to go through how the war played out because we discussed a blow-by-blow progress of the war in season 6, so we're not going to go into it here. But this is the most common reason given by hardcore Zionists. These guys are hardcore Zionists. They don't try to appeal to moral or emotional justifications. They believe that the current situation in Palestine is justified because they won the war and the Arabs lost. Now, they may try to put into another idea that had the Arabs won, they would have wiped them out, or they would have destroyed them or killed them or genocided them. But there's no proof that that was going to happen. Now, this war, the war in 1948, the Arab-Israeli War of 1948, is often described as a small Jewish population surrounded by millions of hostile Arab enemies. And against all odds, this scrappy Jewish community defeated the Arabs, who wanted to wipe them off the map. And it's essentially playing off of the whole Holocaust narrative. Now, there are lots of problems with this myth, and I'm going to try to discuss them here. First of all, the populations of the respective groups, the Jews on one side, Arabs on the other, the populations do not represent the true military capability. Yes, there were about 650,000 Jews in Palestine at the time, compared to nearly 30 million Arabs, not just in Palestine, but also in the surrounding lands around Palestine. This included Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria. So yes, it is true, there were way more Arabs than there were Jews in the area. However, certain things to consider. Number one, Palestinian leadership had been almost completely destroyed by the British. We discussed all this in season 6, but just a very brief recap. The Palestinian Arabs rebelled against the British mandate in Palestine in 1936 because they saw that the British were actively trying to turn their homeland into a Jewish state, which they were doing. Their purpose, the British mandate's purpose, was to implement the Balfour Declaration. There's no disagreement on that. They just realized how impossible this idea was, at least to do it in a way that supposedly represented their egalitarian ideas. Now, this rebellion, the British brutally stomped it out. They brutally repressed this rebellion, and much of the Palestinian military and political leadership were either executed, killed in the fighting, imprisoned, or exiled. So by the time we get to 1948, the Palestinian resistance was a shadow of its former self because the British had almost completely wiped it out. They had kneecapped it completely. Meanwhile, while the British were destroying the Palestinian resistance, they were actively working with various Jewish militias to help them in suppressing the rebellion. So by the time the partition discussion started in 1947, and by the time the war started in 1948, the Palestinians were already fighting from a political and military disadvantage. Now, once the war started, it is true that there were six Arab nations involved. These were, once again, Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria. I believe Saudi Arabia also contributed a very small token for us, but nothing serious. Those are the main six groups: Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria. Even though you have six nations involved, there are only 23 total Arab forces, compared to 30,000 Zionist forces in Palestine at the time. So they were already at a military disadvantage, but nonetheless, even being at a disadvantage, the Arabs in the beginning really weren't doing that bad. Again, the blow-by-blow progress of the war is discussed in Season 6, Episode 11 to be exact. However, things changed as the war progressed. Towards the end of the war, Israel was able to mobilize nearly 90,000 troops. Meanwhile, the Arab armies combined could barely come to 30,000. Jordan was the only Arab nation that fully committed to the war, and it was also the only Arab nation that had a decent fighting force. This was the Arab Legion, which was a well-armed and well-trained Jordanian force. It had been trained by the British, which is why it was so effective. Now, this might seem like a contradiction because the Egyptian forces made up nearly half of all of the Arab forces. So it might seem like, okay, well, it seemed as if Egypt committed a lot more. But Egypt's king was opposed to the war. So Egypt never really fully committed its complete or full political, economic, and political might. Furthermore, the Egyptian forces were really volunteers. There wasn't the full Egyptian military. It was mostly made up of volunteers who had been quickly organized to lead this invasion into Palestine. There's one thing right there. The numbers favored Israel in the beginning and were even more in their favor towards the end of the war. Another thing that we have to understand, and this is something that I misunderstood for very long. I used to think that one of the reasons the Arabs lost was that they were fighting for ethnic reasons. They weren't fighting for Islam. They were fighting for ethnic reasons to defend their Arab brethren in Palestine. Well, I was wrong on that one. They were not fighting for ethnic reasons. Regardless of what they said, I'm talking about the governments, not the Arab people. Regardless of what these Arab governments said, they were not fighting to liberate Palestine. They were fighting because they wanted to grab the territory for themselves. These Arab states had no intention and no desire to create an independent Palestinian state. They wanted to grab as much land as possible, keep the other Arab states from acquiring too much land as well, and they had no desire to destroy Israel. That wasn't their main thing. Their main thing was actually on the same page as Israel. They wanted to prevent the rise of another Arab state in their midst. They didn't mind having an Israeli buffer zone there. They just wanted it to be smaller than what it turned out to be. We discussed this on various occasions, Season 5 and Season 6, during the Arab Revolt. King Abdullah of Jordan accepted the Balfour Declaration. In fact, he had worked with British and Zionist groups against the Ottoman Empire in World War I. So The fact that all of these nations wanted to grab land for themselves, it explains why there was so little cohesion and coordination between the Arab militaries. Now, I did mention earlier that Jordan was the only nation that fully committed to the war. But the reason it did so was because it wanted the West Bank and Jerusalem for itself. Listen to this quote. Abdullah had offered to accept the establishment of Israel in return for Jordanian control of the Arab-populated parts of Palestine. In 1946, Abdullah expressed interest in ruling over the Arab parts of Palestine and had no intention to resist or impede the partition of Palestine and creation of a Jewish state. 100 Years of the Middle East, The Struggle for the Post-Sykes-Picot Middle East by Adnan Khan. Now, the Arab states did give their reason for invading Palestine in May 1948. And in their reasoning, they had a bunch of reasons, but in their reasoning, they didn't mention the rights of the Palestinian people to choose its own government. But if you read past that rhetoric and go to the final clause confirms that they were really more concerned about their own security and what they could get for themselves. Here's a quote from the published reasons that the Arab League gave at that moment for invading Palestine. Quote, "The recent disturbances in Palestine further constitute a serious and direct threat to peace and security within the territories of the Arab states themselves. For these reasons, and considering that the security of Palestine is a sacred trust for them, and out of anxiousness to check the further deterioration of the prevailing conditions and to prevent the spread of disorder and lawlessness into the neighboring Arab lands, and in order to fill the vacuum created by the determination of the mandate and the failure to replace it by any legally constituted authority, the Arab governments find themselves compelled to intervene for the sole purpose of restoring peace and security and establishing law and order in Palestine." Unquote. There's no mention there of protecting the Palestinian people's rights, of establishing a Palestinian state, of wiping out Israel, nothing like that. They're worried about their security and establishing law and order. But really, I'm more or less convinced that the Arab states, not the Arab people, the Arab states, their governments were more concerned about acquiring as much territory as they could. Then, as now, the Palestinian people were being used as a pawn by other nations. All right, so that now brings us to the final example of the Palestinians not truly wanting peace. This is the claim that the Palestinians, represented by Yasser Arafat, rejected the 2000 Camp David peace offer from Ehud Barak. So just in background, again, discussed in season 6, way back in the summer of 2000, President Bill Clinton tried to conclude a lasting peace deal between Israel and Palestine. And so he began working with the then Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and the President of the Palestinian Authority, Yasser Arafat. Ultimately, the peace summit failed and there was no working relationship, no working deal to come out of this peace summit. The following year, Ehud Barak was out of power. Ariel Sharon came, then started the Second Intifada. And then we got, of course, the September 11th and George Bush was in control and all bets were off after that. The common myth is that Ehud Barak and the Israelis bent over backwards and made so many conciliatory gestures and gave up so much to try to make the deal work, but Yasser Arafat rejected it all. This is the myth that has come out of that peace summit. I'm going to read you some quotes that show how the media latched onto this idea and pushed it forward to the point where it became mainstream in society. This first quote comes from the ADL website, the Anti-Defamation League, which I know is not by any means an unbiased organization, but still, let's read this quote. "Faced with criticism after abandoning the negotiations at Camp David and the turn to violence barely 2 months later, Palestinians publicly declared that the failure of Camp David was due to lack of preparation by the Americans, personality differences between Barack and Arafat, and by Barack's take-it-or-leave-it negotiating posture. Many Israeli and American high-level officials who were at Camp David dismiss these excuses and say that Camp David demonstrated that Arafat and the Palestinian leadership had unrealistic expectations that they could force Israel to concede to their maximalist demands without making important compromises of their own. While there were additional negotiating sessions in October and December at the Egyptian resort of Taba, they were conducted in the midst of persistent Palestinian violence, and no agreement was reached. Now, that comes from the ADL, which we know is a shill for Israel and for Zionism. But here are some quotes from mainstream media. Quote, "He did not negotiate in good faith. Indeed, he did not negotiate at all. He just kept saying no to every offer, never making any counterproposals of his own." Unquote. That comes from an article in The Guardian written by Israeli historian Benny Morris, quoting Ehud Barak. Here's another one. Now, this is talking about Bill Clinton reacting to Arafat rejecting the peace offer. Quote, "In the third day of the talks, one participant in the talks said he erupted at what he viewed as unreasonable positions by the Palestinians about the borders for a new state. 'This is ridiculous. This is no way to negotiate,' Clinton said, according to one aide in attendance." Unquote. That quote came from a Washington Post article from the year 2000. Here's another one. Quote, "So, on January 2nd, we had Arafat come to the White House and he didn't say yes. He basically was willing to discuss all the areas where the Israelis were making concessions. He wasn't willing to discuss any of the areas where the Palestinians were supposed to make concessions. So it seemed like he had just said no. But what I subsequently learned, about 18 months later, I had a dinner with a former Palestinian negotiator who'd been part of the delegation. He said the whole Palestinian delegation had decided among themselves they should accept it. They went back to Arafat, and Arafat said no. I subsequently heard from another Palestinian on that delegation who said Arafat thought he could still do a better deal under Bush because he thought maybe Bush will be even more forthcoming." Unquote. Now, this comes from a supposedly liberal organization, liberal media outlet, NPR, on their show, All Things Considered. In this show, they were interviewing Dennis Ross, who was a former special Middle East coordinator for Bill Clinton. So we have here from these multiple quotes this idea that the Palestinians, in particular Yasser Arafat, just did not want peace, and he rejected every single offer the Israelis were giving, every single conciliation, every single concession, all the generous offers coming from Israel. Arafat just refused to accept them. As I mentioned in the first episode of this series, the United States was not a neutral negotiator. It has never been, throughout much of its history dealing with Israel, has it ever been a truly neutral negotiator. This is because of the special relationship. That's what this whole series is about. During the 2000 Camp David summit, any proposal that the United States brought to the Palestinians first had to be presented to the Israelis. This meant that the United States only brought forth ideas to the Palestinians that the Israelis had already accepted. So this puts the U.S. in the position of negotiating for Israel instead of being a neutral arbitrator. And of course, I have proof of this. Quote, "Our no surprise policy with Israel, which in essence meant showing everything first to Israel, and Clinton's unwillingness, in his own words, to jam Barack, stripped away any hope of being an effective mediator. By day four, when we gave Barack a paper he forced us to amend, for all practical purposes, the summit came to an end." Unquote. That quote comes from an article by Aaron David Miller, who was the deputy special Middle East coordinator for Bill Clinton, and it is available on the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace website. So there's one problem right there. The United States was not being an impartial, fair negotiator. Now, I was a full-grown adult during this period of time, and I remember this quote. I don't remember who said it, but I remember this. It's not really a quote, but I remember this statement from some news pundit and stating that if Arafat rejected Ehud Barak's offer, he deserved to deal with Ariel Sharon. It was, I guess it was common knowledge by then that Ariel Sharon was going to replace Ehud Barak as Prime Minister of Israel, and therefore Yasser Arafat deserved to have to negotiate with somebody even much more hardcore, much more hardline than Ehud Barak. Anyway, what were the terms of this generous offer from Ehud Barak and Israel that Arafat supposedly rejected? Well, he did reject it, but what were the terms that he rejected? Let's get into the details. First of all, the offer did state that the Palestinians would get full control of Gaza and 91% of the West Bank. All right, you might think that's a good idea. However, there's always a caveat. The caveat is that Israel would retain control of the Jordan River Valley for several years. And that's where much of the water comes from. When you're living in a desert, water is important, and Israel was going to control the Jordan River Valley for many more years after the proposal was supposed to be accepted. Now, furthermore, the Jordan River Valley made up about 80% of the West Bank. That's why it's called the West Bank. So in reality, the Palestinians were only going to get 10% of the West Bank, while Israel would eventually, sometime in the future, relinquish control of the Jordan River Valley. So that's the first caveat to the whole deal. Secondly, the Palestinian territory in the West Bank would be divided into three cantons, three different areas. And each of these three cantons would be separated by Israeli-controlled territory, similar to the initial partition plan that the United Nations brought up in the first place. So you have three different territories, Arab or Palestinian-controlled territories in the West Bank, but they would not be one contiguous land. They would be divided by Israeli-controlled territory. This territory was going to connect the Jordan River to the rest of Israel, so Israel would always have control of the Jordan River. Furthermore, this would also, of course, weaken Palestinian control over the West Bank. If you always have to cross over Israeli territory to get to another part of your nation, then you don't really have full control over that nation. So that's two reasons why Yasser Arafat rejected the proposal. They were only going to get really 10% of the West Bank initially. And secondly, they're going to divide that 10% up into three separate cantons separated by Israeli territory. The third reason why Yasser Arafat rejected this plan was that the Palestinian state would never be truly sovereign. It wasn't going to be a true state. Israel demanded to retain control over its borders, over its airspace, and most importantly, over its water. Furthermore, this supposed Palestinian state could never create an army. How do you call yourself a state, an independent nation, if you can't have an army, if you don't control your airspace, if you don't control your borders, if you don't control your water? That's not a nation. That's barely a city. So this was one more reason why Yasser Arafat refused to accept this deal. And finally, the final reason why he refused to accept the offer was that this was going to be the final deal. One of the demands that Israel had was that once they made this deal, that was it. The Palestinians had to give up all claims and all grievances after the deal was made. This is not going to be a first step to additional Palestinian sovereignty in the future. This was going to be it. So the demand was, the idea was that we're going to give you this, and after that, shut up and leave us alone and don't bring this up anymore. That's the idea. And Yasser Arafat rejected it for these reasons. No leader in their right mind would accept this. So now I hope that we have successfully debunked these ideas that the Palestinians only wanted violence and never wanted peace. There have been opportunities for peace, but they were never good faith opportunities. There were always opportunities that strove to weaken the Palestinians and give as much power as possible to the Israelis. Now, the point of these last two episodes, this one and the one from last week, was to debunk the reasons for the U.S.'s unconditional support of Israel. My whole point was to show that there's no good reason for this so-called special relationship between the U.S. and Israel. In the previous episode, we were focusing on debunking the political and strategic reasons that were often given for supporting Israel. And in this episode, we wanted to focus on debunking the moral reasons. So now that we see that there's no good reason for it, we have to ask ourselves, why does the United States continue to support Israel in the way that it does? And that's what we're going to address in the next episode, inshallah. So in the next and final episode of this series, we're going to discuss the Israel lobby in the United States. But until then, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.